Excuse me, you're in my personal space. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's been less than a week, and so far people seem to like their light rail trains to Capitol Hill and Husky Stadium. Sound Transit saw a huge opening day last weekend, almost 70,000 riders, and since then there have been thousands more than expected. And that has Seattle figuring out something new: crowded trains. Sound Transit spokesperson Bruce Gray says they're working it out.
We're seeing great ridership. And based on that, we're going to start rolling out some longer trains during peak rush hours.
Longer trains. What about more trains running more often?
Well, we're at trains every 6 minutes right now. And that's about all we have space for in the downtown Seattle Transit Tunnel today. So we're running them as often as we can during rush hours. And the idea is that having a few longer ones mixed in there is going to help ease some of the crowding on the trains.
If I'm a light rail rider, what can I do to help the situation?
That's a great question. When you get on the train, move to the ends of the car. Move to the middle parts of the car. Don't stand right in the doorway area. That's why we've got those bars and straps hanging the length of the trains. You know, make room for everybody. Also, put your backpack on the floor. Put your backpack in front of you. Put your luggage underneath your seat.
Not on the seat next to you.
Not on the seat next to you, and not your backpack on the seat next to you either. These trains are washed down every night. The floors are clean enough that you can put it on the floor for a few minutes.
So this is the phase, Bruce, where we're learning. We're learning how to be big city train riders.
We are learning, and a lot of this may be because we've got a lot of new riders. Folks who are on some bus lines, they know the etiquette of getting on a bus and walking to the back and making room. And it's all part of the growing pains.
But, you know, everybody in every city kind of has to decide how crowded is too crowded, right? New Yorkers might put up with more crowding than Seattleites. So
right.
How do I know, oh, we need more trains, we need longer trains, this is ridiculous, or whether, no, it's just time for you to rethink your personal bubble?
Yeah, I think that personal bubble tends to be a little bigger out here in Seattle among some folks. And over time, people are going to get used to it. You know, we see it especially on, like, special event days when people are taking the train to see the Sounders or the Seahawks. You don't expect to get on there and have a seat the whole ride, and you'll put up with someone being a little closer to you than you might if you're just standing at the grocery. A healthy transit system in a big city is crowded, especially during rush hours.
Of course, maybe a Seattle listener listening to you now is thinking, I don't want to be a New Yorker. I want my Seattle bubble.
Well, I think those same listeners also want to be able to get around the city and not sit in traffic, so I think it's worth it.
Okay, so let's say it's you and me, Bruce.
Okay.
We're on the train. We're headed from the UW to Safeco Field during rush hour.
All right.
What's the picture? Are we sitting down?
If you get on at UW, you are, for sure, because you're on the first train. If you're getting on in the downtown Seattle Transit Tunnel, you probably are not going to get a seat, and you're going to stand for a few minutes until you get to the stadium.
We're standing. We're holding a strap.
That's right. You're getting on, and you're walking to the back of the train. You're walking into the middle section. You're getting out of the doorway. You're holding on to the strap or that bar above you, and you'll be at your destination in a few minutes.
All right. We're strap holding together. Are we touching?
Are you touching?
Yeah.
Depends on the time of day. You might be rubbing shoulders with somebody, and that's not such a scary thing.
Well, yeah. See, what if I said, what's with the touching? Could you move?
I think the way this city is booming, I don't think it should be a big surprise to folks that there's crowds on trains and there's just more people in general in Seattle these days. As more and more people use this system, and as we're seeing today, people are going to get used to the idea that your personal space, you don't get a 3-foot bubble around you.
That's Bruce Gray, spokesperson with Sound Transit. Sound Transit counted 57,000 riders on Tuesday between SeaTac and Husky Stadium. This is KUOW's The Record. What's it going to be? Bernie or Hillary? Washington Democrats get to answer that question Saturday at the state's caucuses. Now let's take you inside the Seattle campaigns for Clinton and Sanders. We sent producer Andy Hurst to the Bernie Sanders campaign office on Capitol Hill, where volunteers told him why they're feeling the burn.
My name is Leslie Zucker. And I'm from Mercer Island, and I'm volunteering. I'm the one who's been making most of the signs that are on our Capitol Hill office walls. Bernie is a real candidate who's taking people on. He's not accepting corporate donations. He's not accepting money from the private prison industry, from the drug companies, you know, from Wall Street. And that says that he's about change. He's about changing the system. And that's something that I feel great about.
My name's Andy Roboto. I am from the Kent area, and I'm a full-time volunteer. I'm also an Iraq veteran. And so that's one of the reasons why I support Bernie, because after serving in Iraq, my experience has turned me into something I don't want to be. And he's always been on the forefront of veterans' issues. And for example, it just took 4 years for the VA to recognize my PTSD. That's a problem. For 4 years, I've been struggling, you know, trying to find my way in the world since Iraq, and he's always been there for us.
Okay, so that was producer Andy Hirst taking you inside the Bernie Sanders campaign on Capitol Hill, the campaign office there. We also talked with volunteers with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Last night, a handful of Clinton volunteers phone banked at a house in the Mount Baker neighborhood.
Hello, is Vicky available? The reason I'm calling is that we are wondering if you have decided who to support in the caucus on Saturday. So you're going with Bernie, huh? Okay. After you caucus for Bernie, you'll vote for Hillary. Okay. Thank you again so much for chatting. Have a great night. Bye-bye. My name is Diana Leitner. I'm from Seattle, and I'm a fellow with the Hillary Clinton campaign. I'm one of those people, you know, you see on Facebook, they're holding up a sign that says, I borrowed $20,000 in student loans. I've paid back $33,000, and somehow I still owe $57,000. That is me. 100%. And I'm supposed to be saving for my kids' college right now. Hillary has a plan to refinance student loans, and that did not come out of Bernie's mouth first.
My name is Michelle Mills. I'm from Seattle, Washington, and I'm here to volunteer for Hillary, making some phone calls. I've been a Hillary supporter since she was in the White House first time as First Lady, mostly because she speaks up for women's rights and civil rights. She's definitely got the know-how to do it. She's got the experience, and I think it's a no-brainer to me that she should be president.
You think she can beat Trump?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if he gets in office, I'm moving to Canada. So.
Voices of Hillary Clinton supporters in the Mount Baker neighborhood last night. Before that, you heard for Bernie Sanders supporters. And if you are a Democrat, you can make your argument for Hillary or Bernie this weekend. Get together with your neighbors, and you get to make your case because the caucuses happen Saturday morning beginning at 10 o'clock. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's common knowledge. You do not want to be on or under the Alaskan Way Viaduct in an earthquake. But you might not know that bridges on I-5 and 405 are also vulnerable to severe earthquake damage. It turns out the concrete columns holding up some big bridges are hollow inside. KUOW's investigative reporter John Ryan takes a look at this little-known weakness inside our heavy infrastructure.
I'm standing by the banks of the Green River in Tukwila, right where it passes underneath Interstate 405. The bottom of the bridge is just a few feet over my head. The main thing keeping that traffic off my head and out of the river is a series of 20 concrete columns. They're all hollow. With me here is WashDOT bridge engineer Dwayne Wilson. Dwayne, why are these columns a concern?
If a severe earthquake hit, there's a high risk that the inside could break loose. And the column could actually implode. So it would collapse on the inside. We don't know exactly the level and the mechanism, but it is a high concern.
Imploding concrete isn't just a concern at this bridge on the Green River. Western Washington has more than 20 bridges built like this, many of them on the busiest highways in the Seattle area. The State Transportation Department has known that the columns are vulnerable for more than a decade. Some of those bridges are being replaced along Highway 520 in Seattle and on I-5 in Tacoma, but the rest, there are no plans to do anything to keep those other bridges on 405, I-5, or elsewhere from collapsing in a big earthquake. Wilson says WashDOT is responsible for some 3,200 bridges around the state.
We're more concerned about just regular deterioration on our older bridges, and we're trying to keep the whole bridge network statewide open, so that is of higher priority right now.
Washington has more highways on hollow supports than other earthquake-prone states. To see why, you have to go back to the 1950s.
These new highways will have a far-reaching economic impact on the entire nation.
America's new interstate highway system is growing at breakneck speed. The highway lobby puts out ads and whole movies to convince the nation it's money well spent.
The nation's road builders, with specialized equipment and modern techniques, build roads of the highest quality at the lowest cost.
One modern technique of the early 60s was a stronger material called pre-stressed concrete. A company in Tacoma called Concrete Tech pioneered its use in America. The stronger concrete meant builders needed less of it to make a column strong enough to hold up a bridge. Those hollow columns were light enough to be built in Tacoma and then trucked up to construction sites around western Washington. Local bridge builders snapped them up, and the Puget Sound region became a hotbed of hollow column bridges. As Dwayne Wilson told me, it made sense at the time. The hollow columns are almost as strong as solid ones, at least when the earth isn't moving.
What was kind of the earthquake thinking back then?
There wasn't really much, especially in the early 60s. Earthquakes just weren't a thought to most bridge engineers.
Engineering professor John Stanton met me beneath another hollow column bridge, Seattle's Portage Bay Bridge on Highway 520. We're standing in a concrete grove of columns. The busy highway is maybe 50 feet over our heads.
If a big earthquake happened right now, here we are, what would you do?
I would stop talking and run to get out from underneath the bridge very rapidly. This is not a good place to be in an earthquake.
Stanton teaches at the University of Washington. His experiments back in the 1980s showed that hollow columns could implode in a big quake.
And a couple of other people had noted the same thing before that, so it wasn't news. At the time, I was not aware that WashDOT had built a lot of bridges using these very large hollow columns.
Decision makers didn't pay much attention to WashDOT's large hollow columns until an accident one night on Lake Washington more than a decade later. In the summer of 2000, a wayward gravel barge plowed into the 520 bridge. A bridge column shattered. The accident helped spur the current megaproject to replace the half-dozen bridges on 520 and its various ramps. A year later, the Nisqually quake generated more interest in making our infrastructure safer in a big earthquake. But WashDOT engineers decided these hollow column bridges were not a priority. Here's Dwayne Wilson with WashDOT.
Nisqually, these bridges survived very well. They didn't experience any damage at all.
But the Nisqually quake was nowhere near as big as what might hit us.
If we get the big one that they're expecting, which is be the subduction zone earthquake, there's a potential for damage.
Geologists say we've got about a 1 in 6 chance of a big one from the Cascadia subduction zone hitting us in the next 50 years, or a big one could strike from the Seattle fault that runs right through the city. So far, WashDOT has spent nearly $200 million trying to harden its old bridges that don't have hollow columns. The agency has focused mostly on bridges that would be critical if the Seattle-Tacoma region needed to recover from a massive quake. WashDOT calls it the seismic lifeline. That lifeline is in long-term limbo.
Over the next 6 years, we are not funding any additional seismic retrofits.
Aside from the money problem, there is no known way to make hollow columns resist earthquakes better. WashDOT has asked John Stanton to see if there's a way out of this conundrum.
With great difficulty.
Stanton says if you tried to fill the hollow columns with concrete, they'd probably just burst from the added pressure. WashDOT has wrapped steel around some solid bridge columns, but that wouldn't stop a hollow column from crumbling apart on the inside. Stanton says if WashDOT can fund the work, he'd need about a year and a half to study whether there's a way to fix the hollow columns. Even if fixing the missing links in the region's seismic lifeline would be difficult and expensive, Stanton says doing so now makes sense.
Right now we're in a period of very low interest rates, and this would be a perfect time to invest in infrastructure because essentially you can buy it cheap. So why aren't we doing that?
Of course, state government and even WashDOT have many competing demands for the tax dollars they spend. WashDOT estimates more than $1 billion of seismic upgrades are still needed on the state's highways. That figure doesn't include any estimate for replacing or fixing the state's hollow columns. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
The government knows there are hundreds of bridges that need seismic retrofitting, but they're not fixing them. And later this afternoon on KUOW, you will hear why. And to see our full investigation, including maps showing bridges near you, go to KUOW.org. Welcome to KUOW's The Record on the 24th of March. If you feel like you're just waking up from a long winter, you're not alone. Bears feel exactly the same way. They're just starting to be more active in the North Cascades. Except for grizzly bears, that is. Scientists think there are very few grizzly bears left in Washington, maybe a couple of dozen. But those grizzlies will eventually repopulate on their own, right?
Well, you can't say if there's two or three of them there, leave them to it, because they won't bounce back in numbers quickly. They're the second slowest reproducing mammal in North America after the muskoxen.
That's Chris Morgan, a bear expert, a filmmaker, and author based in Bellingham. He wants to reintroduce grizzly bears to the North Cascades, possibly by bringing in grizzlies from other places. This could really happen. The National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are looking into it. I asked Chris Morgan why he's so passionate about bringing grizzlies back to Washington.
I'm from a country where we haven't had grizzly bears for 1,000 years. You know, Britain used to have grizzlies, but they didn't get along very well with the Romans, and the Romans won. So, but here we've got this rare window of opportunity to have grizzly bears back as part of our landscape in healthy numbers, and it seems like most people want that. You know, our surveys have said that people see them as part of our national and natural heritage. So there's that Wild West feel about grizzly bears and the pride that comes with that, that they've got an inherent right to be here, a rightful place here, just of their own accord. People value them for future generations. And then people see them as part of the ecosystem, you know, that they are an important part of making an ecosystem work. So there's a lot of support and a lot of good reasons for having them back, but not everybody agrees. So,
well, grizzly bear is a symbol. Fantastic. Grizzly bear in front of you, terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people are petrified at the idea of running into a grizzly bear. And right,
is that wrong?
You know, they're wild animals doing what they do, and sometimes that means defending themselves or their cubs or their food. And, you know, we all know what defending your youngsters is about, you know. It just brings out something visceral, and there is something about that with grizzly bears, and they can be dangerous.
More dangerous than, say, black bears?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, in certain circumstances. So, yeah, it depends on which bear you encounter. And I always say that, you know, just about every grizzly bear or black bear, for that matter, that you encounter is going to be as different as any human you might encounter on the same backcountry trail. Amazing array of different personalities, just as we have in the human world. And you never know which bear you're going to encounter, but hopefully the right bear on the right day. And that's 99% of the encounters that people have. And, you know, myths and folklore and movies, The Revenant. I'm not going to mention any, but The Revenant.
Yeah, don't mention any, but The Revenant.
For example, you know, they haven't done grizzly bears a huge number of favors when it comes to the myth and folklore that surround them. They're a lot less dangerous than you would imagine from what you hear. But the dangers are there. But, you know, I think us as the smarter animal, the smarter mammal, we can take steps to stay safe in bear country. Simple little things like hang your food up so they're not attracted to it when you're camping. Make noise when you're walking down a trail so you don't surprise a bear. They don't like to be surprised. Carry bear spray, way more effective than a firearm. You know, you've got a bear spray, a bear pepper spray on your hip.
You've never seen a grizzly in the North Cascades.
Not.
You've seen signs.
I've seen bear sign. Didn't know whether it was grizzly or black bear, though.
Are there photographs and video of grizzlies walking around in the North Cascades?
There are still photographs of tracks. We have photographs that come from the public each year, but most of them are indecipherable. There's been a certain number of verified sightings, but the verified sightings haven't happened for years, since the late 90s.
People just tuning in think we must be talking about Bigfoot. That's what I'm thinking of.
It is like the search for Sasquatch, for Bigfoot. It's definitely it definitely has that ring about it, doesn't it? Yeah. They are few and far between. I've studied bears all over the world, in places like Spain even, where there are 60 or 70 bears in northern Spain, maybe even more now. But 20 years ago when I was there, you never hoped to see them. Just so elusive and secretive and mostly become nocturnal. Same thing has probably happened here, you know. The only bears that are left are the ones that know how to stay out of humans' way. And
sure.
So that's been a predisposition that has worked for them. So we don't see them very much. But we have a lot of people in the Cascades. You'd think that a decent photograph would turn up by now. But they are few and far between. It's become almost a life mission to find that photograph, you know, or that track, you know. But they're in some very wild, isolated areas in the Cascades. And we've got some big mountains, most of it high elevation and very inaccessible. No matter how easy it is to get across Highway 20, there's a lot of mountains for grizzly bears to hide there.
You might actually see a grizzly bear in the North Cascades. For someone who's never going to come face to face with that bear, why do you think it's so important to know that you're living with grizzlies in Washington State?
Wow, that is, I spend a lot of time thinking about that because I do like to see both sides of any story and both sides of people's opinions, you know, and I understand when people say, look, it affects my livestock or they might affect my livelihood in some way. My heart goes out to those people. My position is that I think that these giant wild landscapes are better with giant, large carnivores on them. It keeps humans humble. It's good for the ecology. It can be really good for the economy. You know, grizzly bears could really boost the economies of communities in the North Cascades and surrounding areas like they've done in Yellowstone.
Meaning busloads of tourists hassling these bears?
Yeah, not hassling them, but coming just because they know that they're in the environment. And I think that speaks to it all. When you know those bears are out there, you get this sense of something bigger and wilder than yourself. And whether you see them or not, just being out in that environment is something just pretty pure and wild that you don't get a taste of very much in today's world. So a lot of my work is figuring out where these wild pockets are around the world and how do we ensure that they stay around. And to have one of them a couple hours from Seattle is something I think most Washingtonians are really proud of.
That's Bellingham-based bear expert Chris Morgan. He would like to reintroduce grizzly bears to the North Cascades. And the government wants to know what you think of that idea. They're asking you to comment on their grizzly bear environmental impact statement. We are now tweeting a link to you so you can find out how to comment. Tell the government what you think about the bears. We're tweeting it out at KUOW. Chris Morgan also has a short movie up where he talks to people on hiking trails about bears and stuff, and you can find that at our website, KUOW.org. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information at 12:30. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Your state lawmakers are in special session. It's about half over, and there's still no agreement on an update to the budget. Election year partisan tensions have been on display since lawmakers first convened back in January. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins looks at what has passed in the legislature, what failed, and what dominated in the 2016 regular session.
Back in January, Seattle's Ballard High School Concert Choir performed the national anthem for the governor's State of the State address. It was a brief moment of harmony in a legislative session marked by moments of sharp partisanship. The sharpest of those moments, arguably, came a month later. That's when majority Republicans in the state Senate decided not to confirm Secretary of Transportation Lynn Peterson. She'd been appointed 3 years earlier by Democratic Governor Jay Inslee.
This is a very, very serious decision.
Senate Budget Chair Andy Hill was the first to make the case for firing Peterson.
But I have no confidence that the agency is in a position to fix the problems they have without a change at the top.
It marked the first time in 20 years the state Senate had voted not to confirm a gubernatorial appointment. The following Monday, Governor Inslee held an angry news conference.
Senate Republicans should be ashamed of what they did last Friday.
Relations between the Democratic governor, who's up for re-election, and Senate Republicans did not improve as the session wore on.
All right, we'll go ahead and call the meeting of the
Senate Law and Justice Committee issued subpoenas and held a series of hearings on the accidental early release of nearly 3,000 prison inmates over a 13-year period. Once again, Republicans zeroed in on whether Inslee was doing enough to hold his agency heads accountable. But even as partisan tensions simmered and sometimes flared, the business of the legislature continued. The first bill signed by Inslee was a bipartisan pledge by lawmakers to take action next year to end the dependence on local school levies to fund public schools. The state has until 2018 to fully fund basic education by order of the Washington Supreme Court. Lawmakers also voted to try to resurrect voter-approved charter schools after the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional. This was a top priority of Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler.
If you sat through those hearings and listened to the teachers, students, the parents, I don't know how you could find it in your heart to vote against it.
But many Democrats did vote no on the belief that charter schools lack accountability and siphon resources from public schools.
Now, this isn't about kids.
State Representative Mike Sells was booed when he suggested on the House floor that moneyed special interests are behind charters.
What this is about were those 22 high-priced lobbyists out there the last few days.
Police accountability was another theme during the 2016 Washington legislative session. Lawmakers voted to create a task force to examine police use of deadly force, and they approved a hotly debated police body camera measure. If more than 250 bills passed, hundreds more fell short. They include a state Voting Rights Act backed by Democrats and a bipartisan push to regulate e-cigarettes. Some of the biggest crowds of the session turned out for hearings on what some Republicans took to calling the
bathroom bill.
This was a Republican-led effort to repeal a new state rule that says transgender people can access the restroom or locker room of their choice. The repeal effort made it all the way to the floor of the state Senate, where it was voted down. Just before the regular session adjourned, an effort to find a bit of harmony again as Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen led a bipartisan rendition of Hallelujah in the Capitol Rotunda. Hallelujah. That performance was also what you might call the Lieutenant Governor's swan song. Owen is not running for re-election after five terms in office. In his goodbye speech, the Democrats spoke of the insanity of partisan politics and warned of D.C.-style gridlock. A few days later, he gaveled lawmakers back into special session because they couldn't agree on the budget. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. When Hillary Clinton spoke to a crowd of Boeing machinists in Everett this week, she made a point about free trade by mentioning Hilliard's beer. You see, Hillary and Bernie disagree about something called the Export-Import Bank. Let me briefly explain. This is a credit agency that helps Boeing sell planes overseas, and it has also helped companies like Hilliard's. Basically, Hillary likes the Export-Import Bank and Bernie doesn't. The story got KUOW's web producer, Isolde Raftery, thinking. If you're campaigning in Washington and you want to make a shout-out to a local beer, what is the right beer to reference? Hi, Isolde.
Hey, Bill.
So Hillary was mentioning Hilliard's in Everett to make a point about trade, and what got your wheels turning about candidates and beer?
Right. So when she mentioned Hilliard's, I was like, what? That's this hipster Ballard brewery. They serve beer in cans. Totally not the kind of beer I would mention to union workers up in Everett who drink at Diamond Knot. And it got me thinking, what beer should presidential candidates mention when they're stumping around Washington State?
I like the question. So you got on the phone and called around. Who did you call and what did you ask?
Right. So I started with Larry Adams at the Blue Moon Tavern. That's this counterculture, gritty, old school Seattle dive bar here
Good choice.
In the U District.
Yeah.
Right. And Larry told me that for Bernie, he would recommend the Schilling cider in a can because Bernie apparently is a simple guy. And I guess he thought Bernie would like cider.
Schilling cider is a simple...
simple guy, simple beverage, I guess.
Got it. Okay.
And then for Hillary, he would recommend the local lager, L-O-G-G-E-R, so a play on lager, which is brewed in white salmon.
White salmon, okay.
Washington. And I guess because, you know, lagers are tough, Hillary's a tough lady, maybe that was the idea there. Several people mentioned to me this tiny little nano brewery called Stoop in Ballard. And so first, apparently they're really nice there, which apparently counts for a lot. But there's also this brewer there whose name is Robin, who's apparently very talented. And I don't know if you know this, but most brewers tend to be men. So it's pretty unique to have a female brewer. And I got thinking maybe, you know, Hillary's having trouble with these feminist millennials and Bernie's also having difficulty with the female demographic. Maybe if they name checked Stoop, some of us would be impressed. I think I actually would be.
Yeah. Okay. Note to the campaigns.
Yeah.
Stoop is might fit your pitch to the voters who are caucusing this Saturday.
I'm definitely going to go check it out.
So we talked about cider. We talked about lager, L-O-G-G-E-R. What about Northwest IPAs?
Right. So my biggest concern when I started doing some reporting on this would be that someone would tell me IPAs have jumped the shark. Not so. Thank goodness.
Okay.
Because I drink IPA. But as you know, people kind of make fun of us here for loving our IPA. And Bob Brenlin at the Fiddler's Inn in Wedgwood told me that IPAs remain the most popular beer in the area. But I also learned that IPAs are a very Washington beer because they contain more hops than a normal beer. And hops are mostly made here in Washington State. The Yakima Valley actually produces 77% of hops in the U.S.
Right. So that is a legit local reference that candidates could win with.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Now you know, candidates and beer. Thanks, Isolde.
Thank you, Bill. Hey, I have a question for you,
yeah.
though, Bill.
Mm.
What kind of beer do you drink?
I like to drink something that I've never had, and if it's dark and rich and chocolatey, and I feel like I've had a meal in one glass, so much the better.
Yum.
Yeah. So talk about that, candidates, if you want my vote. Isolde Raftery, KUOW's web producer. What do you think, listeners? What beer should the candidates mention? Hillary, Bernie, Trump, Cruz? Let us know on Facebook. Tell us on Twitter, at KUOW. This is The Record. State School Superintendent Randy Dorn is thinking about running for governor against fellow Democrat Jay Inslee. There's already a Republican candidate for governor, Seattle Port Commissioner Bill Bryant. So if Randy Dorn decides to run for governor, he would do it as an independent. News analyst and Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter told me why the state school superintendent smells an opportunity right now.
Well, this is a classic Washington governor's race. If you think about it, you have a Democrat who's the incumbent. We often have Democrats who are incumbents.
For 30 years.
For 30 years or something like that. A Republican challenger in Port Commissioner Bill Bryant, who is not terribly well known, but will presumably have plenty of money behind him. And you have a governor, you know, he's not in his strongest shape, shall we say. He's not in his fighting shape.
Why is that?
There have been big troubles with the Department of Corrections, with prisoners.
Prisoners getting released early?
Too early. And a sense that the Washington Supreme Court has been demanding that the legislature fully fund basic education. And this year, all that was agreed upon so far was a plan to fund basic education. So a sense that things aren't sort of marching along.
And by the way, this thorny issue of funding state education, that is the number one issue of this new candidate, Randy Dorn, superintendent of public instruction.
So Randy Dorn has been the superintendent of public instruction for about 8 years. It's a nonpartisan office, although everybody knows that Randy Dorn before that was a Democrat because he was in the legislature as a Democrat. But he is taking this issue and saying, I don't think the two candidates in this race are strong enough about education, not as strong as I am. And I really want to do whatever it takes to fully fund basic education. I don't feel that these two are going to do it without me there somehow, some way.
And what is his pitch to us Washingtonians that he can do what Governor Inslee hasn't?
Well, his pitch is simply that he understands that we have to raise revenue, and he's saying that he's the one with the guts to do that.
The guts.
Not so much the bucks, but the guts. And so he has said that he would be for an income tax. He has said he would be for raising the sales tax or property tax, that he would be the one to do it, to fully pay for education.
So maybe Randy Doran sees more openness to new taxes in Washington than Governor Inslee has seen?
Governor Inslee tried a couple of taxes along with the legislature, and they just simply didn't pass. One was a capital gains tax, and one was a tax on pollution to pay in part for education. And it just didn't happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about Randy Doran's chances. He would be running as an independent?
Yeah, with a big giant I after his name, which, you know, he's operating on this theory, Randy Doran, that this is the crazy year in politics. Anything can happen. So let's say he files, and this is what he's thinking, sometimes during the May filing week, and he would have a bully pulpit to talk about this in a big way all through the summer through the primary, which is in August. But history says that no independent candidate in a major statewide race has ever advanced to the general. And so, you know, he would really have to buck a lot of tides here for that to happen.
Why is it so hard to run as an independent in Washington?
Well, since we have the top two primary, only two candidates advance. So it's one or the other. Well, the money would be behind the two major party candidates. And there's nothing Randy Doran can do about that other than, as he said, he would use a lot of social media. He would just try to get his issue out there.
Do you think Randy Doran is just drawing attention to his pet issue, or do you think he really wants to be and intends to file as a candidate for governor of Washington State?
I think he really, first and foremost, wants to highlight the heck out of his issue. I think he will file, but I can't honestly tell you that, you know, that he has big plans as the governor. He has big plans to really do right by education.
News analyst Joni Balter on why state school superintendent Randy Doran might jump into the governor's race against Jay Inslee and former Seattle Port Commissioner Bill Bryant. Your deadline to register to vote in the August primary is the 4th of July. And if you're already a registered Democrat, you can caucus in the presidential primary, rather the presidential caucus, this Saturday. We've got more information about how to do that at KUOW.org. Should children who face deportation be entitled to a government-appointed attorney? That's the question before a federal judge in Seattle today. KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones is at the courthouse. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
What is today's case about?
Well, this is a case that started about 2 years ago in 2014, and it's about children who come into this country illegally, who come alone, unaccompanied, without a parent or a legal guardian, and they get put into deportation proceedings, again, with no parent attached to their case. This is connected to a large surge we've seen of children mostly coming from Central America in recent years. Many of them are coming to flee gang violence or poverty there in their home country. And it's really about a question of whether these children, when they go in front of an immigration judge facing deportation, what due process are they entitled to? Are they entitled to an attorney at the government expense? Is that the only way that they can get a full and fair hearing? What's kind of being considered here today, one of the central questions is, should these cases be considered on an individual case-by-case basis, or should this be a larger class kind of case that encompasses children around the country that are in the same situation?
What are the arguments on both sides?
Well, we're seeing from the Department of Justice, the federal side here, from day one, they've wanted to dismiss this case. And the argument there is this there's no jurisdiction for this court to be taking up this issue. They say it's a question for Congress to decide, a question for Congress to fund. The attorney for justice today said, you know, we're sympathetic to these children, but this case law shows precedent. There's no due process right that's being violated here, and made the comment that we hope Congress will fix this. And there is, in fact, a bill in Congress now that would have the same goal, but that's does not have majority support, so it's probably not moving anywhere fast. On the other side, the attorneys for children say the Constitution guarantees a full and fair hearing for these individuals. That is only possible if there's an attorney there to represent them. The attorney, one of the attorneys in this case, is with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project here in Seattle, Matt Adams, and he made the comment, in what other proceeding do you see this? Why is immigration law an exception? There's no justification to make it exception. He said in every other court proceeding where you might have a child involved, they would have a right to counsel.
Okay, so Liz, as you've told us, this is about whether or not children facing deportation should get a government-appointed attorney. How many kids go before the courts without an attorney?
The estimates are kind of different on either side of this case, but about average, about 40,000 children per year, minors, people who are under 18, face an immigration judge in this situation every year on average. It's unclear how many of, about half of those 40,000 don't have an attorney. What's unclear is if this were certified as a class suit, it's unclear how many individuals would actually be a part of that class. Along those lines of numbers, the attorney for justice for the federal government today made a comment that 72% of minors who do show up in court are not being ordered removed, or they're not being ordered deported. He has made, this the same attorney has been hearings here in the Seattle court at least three different times that I've seen, and the last time he was a little bit loose with the numbers and had to kind of go back and change the numbers that he gave or retract them. So it's, those numbers are a little fluid, or a little kind of depends who you ask. And I should also point out that each court around the country handles these cases somewhat differently. You might have like a friend of a court in a situation that's advocating on behalf of the child, but not necessarily an attorney. So like in Washington State, you might see fewer case closures with deportations, whereas in Georgia, you might see a lot more, either because they're getting assistance in one place over another, or judges just have a kind of a different look at how these cases go.
So a child faces deportation, has no attorney. What happens in one of those cases? Can you tell us about one?
Yeah, I'll tell you about Gustavo Gonzalez is an individual I met just a few days ago. He came to the U.S. when he was 17 years old, crossed the border illegally. His mother had abandoned him when he was age 2. When he was 12 years old, his father got sick with AIDS, and Gustavo dropped out of school and started working, finding odd jobs on the streets. And when he was 17, he crossed the border and came into custody of U.S. authorities here. He had an aunt here in Seattle that he came to stay with, and he was actually in a detention shelter for a little while, too, and found a brochure about a number to call, and he called an attorney here in Seattle and found out that he was eligible for a special immigrant visa because of the persecution he had gone through in his home country and his fear of returning there. There's some gang activity that he'd been involved in or was threatened by. So it was a really short deadline for him. He had to make his case before he turned 18. He came to that attorney just months before he turned 18, and he had already gone in front of an immigration judge and said he had no idea what was going on. It was really hard for him to understand. He felt the judge was trying to help him in his case or trying to be patient with him, but he said he was really in the dark. And if he had not found that attorney, he never would have known about this special visa that he was eligible for, and he did end up getting a green card to stay in this country and is now in high school here in Seattle.
Is anyone really arguing that these kids can properly represent themselves without a government-appointed lawyer?
Yeah, this recently came up in this case. There is a separate appeals going. As I mentioned, the government's trying to get it dismissed, so that's in the appeals court here in Seattle. In a deposition in that case, a longtime immigration judge with the federal government who trains judges on how to give a fair hearing, he made a comment about that he's taught immigration law to children as young as 3 or 4 years old. And he said, yeah, it's difficult and it requires a lot of patience, but it can be done. Those comments got a lot of backlash in the media, but also in Congress. There was a congressional hearing recently where he was grilled about, is this, or not he was grilled, but officials were grilled about whether this was really representative of the government's position on this issue, whether 3 or 4 year olds can really represent themselves fairly in court.
Liz, we just have a minute left. So briefly, what's next in this case?
What's next is Judge Zille here in Seattle will take a few weeks to decide on the class issue, whether this is just an individual, a few individual cases, or it applies to many thousands of kids nationwide. That's expected in about 3 or 4 weeks. And, you know, he did push back to the government attorneys here saying there might be rights that Congress can give, but Congress can take those rights away. Isn't that right? And kind of pointing out the line between what we can do in the court versus what we'll do in Congress and what might be permanent.
A Seattle federal judge today considering whether minors who face deportation should be entitled to a government-appointed attorney. KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones joining us live. Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is KUOW's The Record.